The sounds of a party are unmistakable. That one, by the way, is carnival in Brazil. But sometimes, if you're not paying attention, the end of the party, or a good time, can take you by surprise. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of February 27th, 2015. Today, booms and busts in our personal economies and entire nations. Plus, a chat with Bo Willimon, creator of House of Cards. But first, we're halfway through our six-week partnership with the BBC called Six Routes to Riches, exploring how to make it in six places in the new global economy. In the first week, we went to Germany. Last week, we explored Nigeria's entrepreneurism. This week, Brazil. Once South America's powerhouse, now threatened by a stall. I reported in Brazil for 2 weeks as part of our series with the BBC. We're traveling around the world and hearing from people in their own voices, those who've made it and those still trying. Brazil is a country where millions of people, especially young people, use social media. While I was there, I worked with Ricardo Senha, the BBC's social media producer in São Paulo. He's been asking questions on Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp to get a sense of how Brazilians feel about their economic futures. Hi, Ricardo. What were you trying to learn from Brazilians on social media?
We were wanting to hear what Brazilian people on social media have to talk about social mobility and social inequality here in Brazil. So we sent a few call to actions asking questions for our audience, mainly on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. And we had amazing responses, more than 5,000 likes, comments, and shares. People were excited to talk about economics.
Tell me about some of the specific questions we asked, and then let's share some of those responses, because we have audio of what people said to us.
Oh, great. Well, we've asked questions like, do you think you spend more money than you would like? Or how to get richer in Brazil without getting your hands dirty? And the answers are very polarized. I think they show how Brazil is divided about politics and economy. For example, since last year, after PT, the Workers' Party re-election, the country is facing economic stagnation, corruption allegations, and the rise of unemployment. The most recent rates from today show that unemployment is now 20% bigger than it was a year ago. So by one side, people say they're afraid of losing some social gains from last 10 years, and we're talking here about stability, more people in the medium class. And by the other hand, some are optimistic and say that poor people now live better than before. That's the case of a woman named Kelly Mantovani. She's from São Paulo, and she sent her testimony via WhatsApp for BBC Brazil.
And we're going to play Kelly's answer. You're going to hear her voice in Portuguese and then the voice of a translator.
Sou Kelly Mantovani.
My name is Kelly Mantovani and I'm 22 years old. I believe our reality is changing. Now we can access consumer goods that only richer people could access before. My family is a great example of it.
That was Kelly in São Paulo. I know we also had a response about what's the best way to get rich. We're going to hear from Marcos and also hear the voice of a translator. Tell me what he was responding to.
Marcos, on the other hand, is pessimistic about politics and economy here in Brazil. He says, we're a giant state which tries to embrace everything and provides bad services. For him, we have to pay twice for safety, for health, for education.
My name is Marcos Paulo. I am 27 years old and I live in Uberaba City, Minas Gerais state. In my opinion, the state needs to act as a watchdog to make the world richer. It can't disrupt the private sector and needs to invest hugely in education. My personal experience begins at 18, when I started working on my own. I had to run after my studies, and it was when I realized how hard it is to live in Brazil, especially because of the taxes. We pay a lot and have a minimum return in health, education, and security.
Talking about taxes was something we heard a lot, in part because the government has just imposed new austerity measures to make up for budget deficit and also the slowing economy. When you talk to young people on social media, do you get a sense that they are pessimistic just about the short term or about the long term as well?
These are new questions for these young people. I think they're discovering these kind of issues now and trying to reflect about it. First, I think they're worried if they will have money to pay their cinema next month. But at the same time, I think many people are worried too if they will be able to buy a house or to have a nice health plan or etc.
One of the things I noticed when you and I were talking in São Paulo was just how many people were on their mobile phones or on a social network. Tell me about how Brazilians use social media in general.
Brazil is known outside as a social media country. The World Cup and the recent elections on October, I think they're good examples of that. The candidates' campaigns, for example, they were focused on this public because mainly the discussions were being made on social media. There are 80 million Brazilians only on Facebook.
And well, that's like half the country.
Yes, it's almost half the country. We're 200 million Brazilians here. And I think the mobile market growth helps to explain that. And that's why the responses for our call to actions were so expressive, too.
Ricardo Senha, BBC social media producer in São Paulo. Thank you so much. Obrigada.
Thank you, Lizzie. Obrigado. And see you next time.
We just heard about social media in Brazil. Now we're going to talk about an app that's taken off here. Pay attention, it goes quickly. It's what we're talking about today when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Meg Kramer is a producer for Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life this week, and our resident millennial. Welcome, Meg.
Hi, Lizzie.
I'm using that descriptor for you because we're going to talk about Snapchat this week.
Oh, I love Snapchat.
I know you do. And we're talking about it this week in part because it keeps coming into the mainstream consciousness. Vanity Fair, Condé Nast, storied media brand, sent Snapchats from inside its very fancy Oscars party. So they're like these little disappearing messages. People felt like they were hanging out with Beyonce on the couch.
Yeah, and the pictures are not fancy either, right? If you look at them, they're kind of grainy. They're not very well lit. It looks like the kind of bad smartphone picture you might take at a bar or a club or something like that.
As if these are your friends.
Right.
Okay, so why is this appealing exactly?
I think it's appealing because there are so many glamorous pictures of Beyoncé out there. It's interesting and especially exciting for younger people to see pictures of celebrities that look like pictures of their friends.
Explain to me then, how do you use Snapchat? What do you do with it? You use it all the time.
Oh, I use it every day. I Snapchat more than I text. So basically the way that it
this
works...
This is a sentence that wouldn't have existed a few years ago. I Snapchat more than I text. Okay.
You use the app to take a picture or shoot a short video, and then you send it to somebody else who uses the app. And they have only 10 seconds to look at it before it basically disappears forever, which in some ways makes it more like real life than other kinds of communications technologies.
I recognize that if there are teenagers listening to this, they are laughing at me. Because this is the golden teenager demographic that people want, right? 13 to 25, this is a Snapchat demographic?
Right. Most of Snapchat's users are between the age of 13 and 25.
But there is big money here. Bloomberg reported last week that Snapchat could be worth how much money?
$19 billion.
Okay, so connect these dots for me. That makes no sense. How is this worth potentially $19 billion?
I don't think it's hard to make the case that Snapchat is a valuable company, even though the thing that it does seems totally frivolous, right? Like you just...
It's ephemeral.
Yeah, you send a picture, it only lasts 10 seconds. Maybe you have drawn a mustache on it. But consider all of the other things that Snapchat does. In the last year, the company has added person-to-person money transfers, sponsored content, branded channels, all of which will be great ways for it to make money farther down the line.
The flip side of this, of course, is that perhaps the very fact that you and I are having this conversation could mean, oh dear God, Snapchat is no longer cool.
Right. And the fear here is that Snapchat will, like Facebook, become so mainstream that all of these trendy millennial kids won't want to use it anymore. There's all of this sort of pressure to present yourself in a way that limits the way that you use the tool. I don't think that will happen with Snapchat.
Why not?
I think that there is room for everyone on Snapchat. And it's because your network of contacts on Snapchat is so narrow. It's not a portal to the internet. It's just a portal to somebody else's pocket. And that communication is private. If Facebook feels like your high school reunion, this feels like a VIP room.
How are companies and brands using Snapchat now? And where are they thinking about taking it in the future?
Snapchat recently added this Discover feature. So all of these channels like CNN, Cosmopolitan, Vice, ESPN have their own channel that they can use to broadcast whatever they want to all of Snapchat's users. And so I think that brands are just starting to experiment with what it would mean to have an audience on Snapchat in the way that they have an audience on Twitter or an audience on Facebook. And we're going to start to see more of that coming to the foreground, I think, in the next couple of months, over the next year, as they realize this is the way that we can use these content streams to sell ads or market our products.
As someone who went through the first dot-com wave, I have to raise a very skeptical eyebrow at this, though, and say, really? Billions of dollars for disappearing picture messages and massive companies putting money into this? It all sounds a little insane.
You could compare it to another hyped messaging app, which would be WhatsApp. Facebook paid $19 billion for WhatsApp last year. WhatsApp has 3 times as many users as Snapchat. But I think one thing that both of these apps have in common is that there is room within a very simple framework for them to add new functions. If Snapchat proves that it can sort of expand to accommodate new things that people want to do with apps like this, it can almost begin to prove its value. And that's what that $19 billion is about.
Meg Kramer is a producer for Marketplace Tech. Thank you so much, Meg.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We now turn to more from our special series with the BBC, Six Routes to Riches, an in-depth look at the challenges and opportunities people face as they make a living around the world. We're taking a tour of 6 countries at the heart of the changing global economy. This week, we're in Brazil. We're at a samba school in a hangar in Sao Paulo, and you can hear the sound of musicians and dancers rehearsing for carnival. That's the country's annual party. We're here to find out what it takes to make it, to build a good life in Brazil today, but also to understand where Brazil, which has been South America's powerhouse in the past few years, fits into the global economy. The mood here is festive, carnival always is, but there's a sense of unease among people we've talked to. Credit is tight. The national oil company Petrobras is deep in a scandal that reaches into President Dilma Rousseff's political party. And growth has essentially fallen off a cliff. It's a long way from where Brazil was just 5 years ago. Back then, the country was growing at a rate of 7.5%. Brazil's natural resources, like iron ore, beef, and soy, were being sold around the world, fueling the boom in China, bringing massive profits home to Brazil, creating a new Brazilian consumer class, and also making some people simply staggering amounts of money. Guards with vests and guns are searching our car at a sunny gated compound about an hour outside São Paulo as our Brazilian producer Marina Vancel translates.
What are they doing, Marina?
They are opening the car to check for security. They want to make sure that it's just the three of us and the driver, that there's no one coming in that could eventually rob or practice any kind of crime.
There are about 300 houses, mansions really, inside these gates, and one of them belongs to João Carlos Cavalcanti, although he prefers to go by JC. Cavalcanti is 67, a geologist by training.
He grew up middle class, but made his money in iron ore, finding a large deposit in Bahia State in the north of Brazil. He invited us to his villa for lunch and a tour, where he showed me a magazine featuring him and a private jet on the cover. There's a fireplace that's probably 7 feet long. This is just one of Cavalcanti and his wife Henilce's many homes, and a testament to how much money was made in mining. So this is an architect-designed doghouse, huh?
Yeah.
I have to ask you, how much did the doghouse cost?
Quanto custou ela que você quer te perguntar?
Essa casa?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. $4,000-$5,000.
Some $4,000-$5,000 US.
But for all that specificity, Cavalcanti refused to tell me just how rich he was. Forbes Brazil estimated his worth at just over $1 billion in 2013. How much money are you worth?
Não, eu não gostaria, ou seja, eu não gosto, não, não é bom.
Three things that people should never know about you. Number one.
Number one. Qual a sua religião que você professa?
What's your religion?
Okay. Number two.
Number two.
Quanto você tem no bolso?
How much do you have in your pocket?
Number three. Qual a sua opção sexual?
What's your sexual option?
Só essas coisas, só você sabe.
Only you okay. should know about
não
that.
Gostaria.
The divide between rich and poor, though, was stark on our drive through the compound in his bulletproof car.
Para evitar a proliferação de favelas no entorno.
So, and the owners of the land here, they also bought all the land around it, like a belt, to prevent from shantytowns from coming.
Wow.
So they own the land within the compound and a safety belt right around it.
Just to make that clear, the elite in this compound purchased essentially a moat of land to make sure that nobody built slums or favelas too close to their estates. But our conversation didn't just reflect a physical separation from the lower classes, but a philosophical one, too.
So do you think that people who are poor deserve to be poor?
Eu acho, não sei, a Nilce não vai responder, que ela está com a afônica. Nada é o acaso.
So all these things, there is a why, there is a reason, there is a because. And why are these people living in the shanty towns in Brooklyn, in Africa, and in the favelas, everywhere in Mumbai here? Why is that? There must be a reason for these people to be there.
Cavalcanti's reasons why are rooted in what he says are a daily meditation practice and a belief in karma. But on the economic side, the commodities boom that made him rich also began to change the lives of regular people, not just the elite. We went to see Hector Gomez Ang, who runs the Brazil program for the World Bank's International Finance Corporation. When was the moment that the middle class in Brazil started to rise? What happened?
You can trace it back somewhere in the 2000s, sort of over the last decade. This is something that has been happening. Combination of things. Brazil rode the commodity cycle, right? So this led to job creation. The story of the middle class in Brazil, in our view, is a story of job creation and access to credit.
Add to that the government's direct payments to the poorest of the poor in Brazil, known as the Bolsa Família. When you do that, about 50 million people, yes, 50, joined the middle class between 2003 and 2014. That's according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. In Brazil, socioeconomic classes are grouped by letters, A through E. It was first done by academics, and now just about everyone uses them. Class A includes both the well-off and the stratospherically rich, like Cavalcanti. B is mostly educated professionals. C, the middle class, maybe some with university degrees. Class D folks tend to work in the service sector. Class E earn minimum wage or are unemployed. And that middle class, Class C, is now the biggest group of people in the entire country. This discount department store, Casas Bahia, is all about selling to Class C. A washing machine, a living room set, a cooktop, pretty much anything you need to start a life. When we visited, there were a lot of shoppers crowded around the mobile phone counters. Casas Bahia also offers store credit, allowing customers to buy on installments. That's something that's been central to its business model for almost 50 years.
Leandro Botello is buying a computer on the store's installment plan with interest.
Yes, it's a credit application. It's the first time that I'm doing this. Really first time.
We spoke to Rafael Klein, Casas Bahia's former CEO and the grandson of the company's founder.
Why? Why make this the business model? Why is this so important to the company?
Because you got to have trust. I think at the end, everybody's good. We all can have our moments, but at the end, you truly have to give out credit and help them in a way that you believe. If you don't believe in a customer, don't give him credit. And if you don't trust him, don't give him anything. But it's important to give back to society what society was able to give to us.
Casas Bahia built their business on Brazilian middle-class consumers. Brazilian consumers are spending, but consumer confidence fell in January to its lowest level in 10 years. The economy just isn't growing. And like the shoppers at Casas Bahia, a lot of Brazilians have debt. The average family here spends about a fifth of its income just to pay it off. And in Brazil, there's no trip to bankruptcy court to get out of it. But the biggest economic storm cloud right now, even for regular people, it's actually the biggest company in Brazil, and the Southern Hemisphere for that matter, the oil giant Petrobras. Some 80,000 people work there, thousands more at its contractors across Brazil. The government still controls part of Petrobras, and right now, the company is in the middle of a giant corruption scandal for executives allegedly funneling millions of dollars to friendly companies and politicians in President Dilma Rousseff's political party. Even on a regular weeknight in a middle-class family outside São Paulo, Petrobras and the potential fallout come up at dinner.
Do you think it will affect your lives?
Yes, it's already affecting us through the increase in the cost of living. Light is going up 26%. Water is scarce. There's going to be a rationing and also an increase. The government does not have the structure, and this is affecting us. And we pay the taxes, and we get no proper structure. That's why everything in Brazil is absurd.
That's Eleonora de Mello. She's 26 and works in a high-end mall in São Paulo. She invited us to have dinner with her mother, her brother Lucas, and sisters Daniela and Vanessa in the suburbs. When we asked them where they think they fall on the economic ladder, well, just listen to Eleonora tease her younger siblings Vanessa and Lucas.
Where do you guys say you would consider yourselves? You know, they have the rankings, the class A, class B, class C, class D, class E. Where are you? Mm-hmm.
Classe P.
Classe C.
Eu acho que é B.
Classe C. Classe C
pra baixo,
viu?
Classe C.
A, B, C.
Classe C.
Eu consideraria mais classe C, pessoas que, por exemplo, moram em barracos de...
She considers herself class B because her home is made of bricks and it has proper sewage and it's a proper construction.
And Eleanor is rolling her eyes at her.
Eu acho que é C. É assim.
She thinks it's C because of their situation, the difficulties that they go through, because they have to take the bus, they don't have the money to buy big things and pay at once, they have to undergo financing to buy a car, or they have to do the same if you want to have a house, and that the houses in this neighborhood, they are not like... It's not like a pattern of houses. They are not like the same. The way that the constructions are built is a little bit out of order. So she says that class B are those who live in proper neighborhoods with all the houses architecturally in order. This neighborhood, she thinks, is a bit of a mess. So because the houses are constructed one next to each other and they don't have exactly a pattern, an ordinated pattern among them.
I think we got our answer with everybody disagreeing.
What that conversation gets at, though, is just how fluid and tenuous success can feel in Brazil right now. With the economy slow and inflation picking up, even when you've worked so hard to build a good life. Eleonora's mother, Cleide de Mello, was kicked out of her family's house as a pregnant 17-year-old. She found work as a maid in São Paulo and cooked and catered food on the side for more money.
Ah, filha, eu trabalho para ajudar os filhos.
I work to help my children. I always work. Every month I have to give 500, 600 for Vanessa to help her pay the university, or I help pay the health plan for my children, for Lucas. Here it's me and God. I work from Sunday to Sunday, and I don't have holidays. I sell out my holidays to make more money.
Her chicken fricassee and cheese souffle, by the way, are delicious. Clayty DeMello paid for this house, where she's preparing dinner, over the course of 10 years. It's narrow, with three main rooms, and up a brick staircase from the street. A bathroom tap is exposed, and the bricks are uneven, but it's spotless and filled with family photos of three generations. And Clayty says paying off her debt, owning it free and clear, was second only to having her kids.
It was the greatest joy of my life, because when I was pregnant, I lived in the street, and I did everything I could to leave this home to my children as a way to reassure them that if, when I die, they will have something for them. So it was the greatest joy of my life.
Eleonora and her husband live upstairs. She works on salary and commission at an upscale teen clothing store in a San Paulo luxury mall. But on the weekends, she's taking classes to become a makeup artist. She says she's already seen the economy slow down. People just aren't buying what they used to.
O shopping que eu trabalho é o shopping mais antigo de São Paulo, o shopping mais reconhecido e o mais tradicional.
I work in the most renowned and most traditional mall in São Paulo, and the clients that we have are loyal clients, old clients, who have high standards, but now they are afraid to expand, to spend. They are not buying as before, and I am afraid too, because my money, my work, will represent my money, which through this money of my work, I'll be able to afford my future and hopefully my salon in the future.
Eleonora and her siblings joke that they feel like sardines when they cram themselves onto the bus or the subway. Her sister Vanessa, who's studying to be a dentist, is frustrated by the public health system. And everyone feels like the taxes they pay, which have just gone up as part of new austerity measures, aren't getting them enough. Even from the former finance minister, Rubens Recupero. He helped manage Brazil's hyperinflation in the 1990s and now teaches economics.
People now, they have come to a higher level. So the improvement was basically concentrated inside the home, where they have a better furniture, better home, better electric appliance, better pay. They can buy more food. All this is good. But when they need to go to school, school is a better quality. If they need to go to a hospital, a public hospital, the quality is not good.
Although he's not in President Rousseff's party, he does credit her and her predecessor with alleviating Brazil's worst inequality. Still, he fears the weak economy could start to pull some of the new middle class back down.
There is no doubt that the social gains in Brazil are impressive. The problem is, will they be able to keep that? And it's very doubtful.
No one in the current finance ministry or central bank would speak with us on tape. But Marcio França, the vice governor of São Paulo, acknowledged that public services and infrastructure in Brazil still have a long way to go, saying there's something his grandchildren will see.
Only 10 years, this is what it will take for us to do this last stage of improvements, which is providing the public services with the proper quality.
And that may be the place, if Brazil slips into recession, as many economists think it will, where middle-class families feel the pinch the hardest. There have been cuts to pensions and unemployment benefits already, new taxes on gas and loans, and there may even be long commutes for another job if Brazilian employers start letting people go. When we ate dinner with Eleonora and Clayty DeMello and their family, we were struck by their faith, both religious, you can hear them praying for me here, and also faith that despite the slowing economy, they can still make a better life for the next generation. For Clayty's grandson, João, it's a dichotomy we heard repeated almost every day in Brazil. Hope for the future, but worry that the near term would be a struggle. When Eleonora climbed on her motorcycle for the hour-long commute to her job at the mall, she told us every day was a combination of prayer, thanks, and fight. You can share your stories about how you're making it in this global economy on social media. Use the hashtag #SixRoots. Next week, we'll turn our attention to another country with an emerging middle class that's becoming a dominant player in the global economy, a trip to India. If you've missed any of our other stops, including Germany and Nigeria, you can catch up on our website at smartmarketplace.org and click on the Six Roots link. This weekend, House of Cards returns to Netflix for its third season. The show, Netflix's first original one, changed both the way we create and consume TV. And its dark story about power in Washington won the first Emmys ever given to an online series. Whether you're going to watch it all on your laptop and your pajamas this weekend or space it out, we wanted to know more about the business model and the culture of secrecy around the show. So we spoke to House of Cards showrunner and creator Bo Willimon. Full disclosure, he and I have been social acquaintances for about 15 years. Bo, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
You have to tell me where you are and what you're doing, because this is a little unusual.
I'm at a gas station on the Bluegrass Parkway in Kentucky, and I'm a big Civil War buff, so I took the day to drive out to the Perryville battlefield and then on to Lincoln's birthplace.
Is it reading too much into what you do to sort of look at your love of Civil War sites and history?
Well, really, I'm a student of history. One of the majors I had in college was history, and I focused in on the Civil War and Reconstruction. I just think it's a fascinating time of our collective story, and there's nothing quite like being in the place itself to really feel that history.
So by now, everybody knows you guys had a leak of season 3. It hit the internet. You tweeted about it. Where were you when that happened? How'd you find out?
I was in New York and started to get a lot of calls. When I found out what happened, I was more amused than anything. I take great pains to make sure that I don't reveal anything about an upcoming season, and that sort of undid some of that work. But I don't think there was a lot of harm done. And in fact, more than anything, it showed us how excited people were about season 3. The internet went crazy and a lot of fans were really excited by this leak. I wish we could take credit for it.
A lot of people thought it was a marketing ploy.
You know, if it was, and we did do it purposefully, I wouldn't tell you. But the truth of the matter is it was a technical glitch. And you know, we're still figuring out streaming television, and occasionally stuff like this happens. I think Frank Underwood would have taken credit for it. I don't think we can, though.
Yeah, but then I'd probably be dead. You have a constant dance with secrecy that you do around this show and within it. Can you quantify how much secrecy matters to you in your process?
Well, in terms of writing the show, it just boils down to we don't want to spoil anything for anyone. When you release a show in its entirety, a season in one day, that means within hours you have the potential for a smorgasbord of spoilers. And there's nothing we can do to control that. But what we can control is, prior to that launch, not giving too much away. We want to have our audience have the purest experience possible, so we don't need to contribute to the spoilers ahead of time. There'll be plenty of spoilers once the show comes out. And then in terms of secrecy as a theme or a subject, I think it's a fascinating one. And that really comes down to information as a form of power. Those that have information have a certain power over those who don't. In the fog of war, that person or entity that can look farthest into the fog has an advantage. So when you're writing a show about power, that's one of the tactics for maintaining it or acquiring it, which is to have more information than the next person and to be secretive about the information you have.
Well, you've drawn a nice analogy also to the business model of what you're doing, because one of the questions so many people have is, how many viewers do you have? What's the metric for success?
Well, I still to this day have no idea how many people have watched House of Cards. I don't know the numbers. Netflix has not shared them with me or any of the creative team. And that's just fine with us, as long as they're happy and want to keep making the show. I think that the metrics for success have been changing in television. It's not necessarily just the objective number, how many people watched. I mean, for a lot of places, like take HBO, for example, it's about creating a brand. It's about offering something to certain niches within your subscribership that they're not getting anywhere else. When it used to be just about how much you can sell your ad time for, then that number really mattered. Now that's not the only variable in the equation, so there's a lot of different ways to gauge success.
I guess that makes sense, but you realize that it comes back to this question of like, okay, if you guys have upended the television model and you're such big disruptors, why not just say it?
Well, you'd have to ask Netflix that, but if I were to speculate, I would say, what incentive do they have? What is the advantage of telling people how many folks are watching your show or the shows that you're producing? It gives information to your competitors that you don't necessarily need them to have. And since you're not selling advertising, it doesn't really, you know, play into any meaningful equation in terms of how much revenue you're going to get. Though, you know, one number that Netflix is very open about is how many subscribers they have. And their subscribership has been growing consistently over the past decade or so. And that's the important thing to them.
Speaking of subscribers, the CFO, David Wells, estimated that launching this season is probably going to bring in 100,000, 150,000 subscribers. That must be a weird tension for an artist. I mean, you're a playwright, but your work is getting mentioned on earnings calls.
Well, I don't really pay much attention or think about that stuff too much. You know, there are people at Netflix whose job it is to think about that stuff and determine how valuable the show is to them based upon how many subscribers it brings in and so on. My goal is only to tell the best story possible, and if it brings in subscribers, great. I think that that's a tension that really anyone working in television faces, no matter what type of network they're writing for. The goal of any network is to bring in the most amount of money, and that there's different ways to do that. It's either by selling advertising or through subscribership, and they rely on their content to do that. But you can't be thinking about that on a daily basis when you're pursuing a creative endeavor.
I want to ask you about this turn toward the end of last season and something that I feel like maybe I'm wrong, but is coming up in the next season, because it makes me wonder, when you've chronicled an ascent to power, you've been around politics for long enough. There's another side to this. Frank can't keep going forever.
Well, it's a great question. What happens once you've achieved the highest office in the land? Many presidents have had to contend with that very question. Is the only way to go down? Do you have to fight to maintain your place on the summit? These are precisely the questions we want the audience to be asking as they click into season three.
Beau Willimon is the showrunner and creator of House of Cards. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Lizzie.
Marketplace Weekend is supported by Epson, with projectors that are helping businesses succeed. Epson's high-impact digital projectors are designed to enhance communication and inspire collaboration. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by Nuance Power PDF, designed for easy implementation to accurately convert, combine, and collaborate on documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. And by Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps so that no one falls victim to them again. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance. Know the gaps.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Last week, we asked you all to consider where you fall on the economic ladder. And we're going to talk about that and listen to your responses to that question. I want to bring in, though, Jill Schlesinger. She is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
It is very nice to talk to you again.
I am so fascinated by this topic, so I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, let's listen to what people said, because we got a lot of really great responses. Let's play the tape.
I'm living paycheck to paycheck.
I have to work for a living.
I stopped out from working to raise two kids, and I thought I'd hop back into the workforce, just jump right back on the train, but it wasn't any particular thing. It's just I've had trouble finding work.
I was catapulted into the middle class. I am wealthy in economic status and in all the ways that really matter.
If I lost my job tomorrow, I would be in trouble, and I think most people fall into that category, and as such, we are all working class.
What do you do when you're in this position and you've fallen back? How do we rise out of this hole and kind of create that brighter picture for our financial future?
I want to start with that last comment. That's a listener named Meredith. So let's say you've fallen down a few rungs using this ladder metaphor. Jill, I know you well enough to know that you're probably going to have both some psychological advice and some financial advice. Where do you start?
I think the reason why so much of the financial world is so difficult is that there are emotions. I mean, you can't sort of sugarcoat the fact like, wow, I got kicked and it hurt. So we're going to say you are entitled to feel bad for yourself. Now that's over. So what are we going to do? So what the way that you're going to get forward is, yet you're allowed to feel, you sit on your pity pot for a little bit, but now it's time to take action. And I always go back to kind of hardcore financial planning, which is, let's figure out where you stand. Now let's figure out where you want to go and how are we going to get you there. Coming up with a game plan is huge. And it doesn't have to be a Harvard Business School study of your financial life. It has to be three goals. That's it. And maybe those goals are literally, I just need to figure out how much money is coming in and going out and identify some amount of money that I can isolate to either pay down debt that's outstanding or to beef up my savings. And maybe that's all you're going to do for the rest of this year, but it's something you can accomplish.
Are there rules of thumb in terms of, say, how much money you should try to save, you know, even a percentage while you're working?
In general, I always look at three basic financial goals that will really keep most people out of trouble. And the first is to always pay down your consumer debt. That's credit cards and auto loans. And I don't put student loans in that category. Number two is to have an emergency reserve fund, which is 6 to 12 months of your living expenses. And the third is to maximize your retirement contributions. I mean, this year you can put $18,000 into a 401k. Most people can't do that, but you're striving to get to that place.
I've been in Brazil, and we've been talking about how the middle class grew in Brazil. It's a very different story here in the U.S. I'm wondering if people can propel themselves up the economic ladder by saving, or if you think that that kind of mobility comes from work or investments. What drives that in this economy?
You know, I think it's been a really long slog for the middle class in the United States. I'm not sure you can save to propel yourself into the next category, whatever that category is. I feel like I'm middle, I want to be upper middle, or I want to be wealthy. Because I think that for most people, they're saving to basically live the life that they're leading right now. They're happy about that, right? Like, I don't believe that there are many people who are saying, I'm making $100,000 a year and I want to figure out how to live on $200,000 in my retirement, right? So how do you propel yourself? Well, you got to get lucky. You can marry into wealth, my mother's favorite one. I didn't quite ever do that one, but I'll try next time. I think that you can inherit wealth. I really believe for most people, it is going into a growth profession. I think that if you were a middle-class kid and you went to coding camp and you are now working at a technology company on the West Coast, you are likely going to be in a different class than your parents.
Wow. Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you so much.
It was so great to be with you.
We heard from a lot of you this week, and we really appreciate it. Next week, we're talking about infrastructure. Talk to us the way you might in a town hall, about sidewalks or a bridge maybe, a community hospital. What's broken in your community, in your home, and what's stopping the fix? Is it money? We want to hear your stories. Write to us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. Now a story about a boom and a bust at the micro level. Alan Prather has always been interested in computers.
But I think it was written into my DNA. And when I was a kid, I started building robots.
In fact, when he was just 17, he wrote code for a robot for Carnegie Mellon. Around 1998, Prather moved to San Francisco to study animation. But one day, he solved a problem for a computer hardware company that no one else had solved. He was then offered his first real job, basically on the spot. It was a lot of money for a 21-year-old, so he called his mom and dad to ask for their advice. Drop out of school, take the job. Here's what they said.
Take it. Take it. Run with it. Take it. And that was it. That was the beginning of, like, my Silicon Valley story. 1999. This was when the Silicon Valley boom started. I got a really luxury apartment across the street, and I spent absurd amounts of money on food, just going out and wine, and all of a sudden, you're this kid from Pittsburgh, and now you're going out with friends and buying, like, bottles of Chateau Lafite Rothschild, and it was just transformative, and kids with prefrontal cortexes that are not developed probably shouldn't have that kind of money. My wallet was more popular than me, I think. We were idiots. And on paper, I was worth about $2.3 million. But it's stock options. It's not money that I can actually use. But I had all these dreams. I'm going to get a Ferrari, and I'm going to buy mom and dad a trip to Italy. It was a crazy, amazing time. The sign that things were starting to fall apart was when I saw my friends. They were losing their jobs. The companies they worked for were collapsing and breaking apart. And I had three or four bosses, and they were leaving. And that's when it started to collapse, when everyone lost faith in, you know, this big pipe dream. So I was laid off. I was laid off along with my entire team. When I transitioned to literally barbacking and doing whatever it took to, like, stay in San Francisco and not, you know, take from my family and to subsist. I had good friends to support me, but it was dark. I went from a beautiful apartment and a really nice car to the bathroom was down the hall. And there were crackheads on my doorstep. So that was a huge dichotomy. Yeah, it sucked, but I'm a pretty determined guy. But I think actually having that sort of boom and then bust was great for me. It not only did I learn a lot more about people by bartending and not sitting behind a computer, but that life experience of having maybe more than you should and then way less... really was transformative, and I think that was really important, like, for growth, to not just being a coder or a software guy, but, like, understanding people.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Jenny Ament. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. On next week's show, we visit India as part of our continuing series with the BBC. Thanks for listening. This is APM.